All right, this is Greek in Plain English, Class 7, for those of you keeping track at home or here in the ballpark with us. Tonight we're going to do participles, but before we do, last week after class ended and all the recording devices were turned off, a question was asked about a passage in Matthew, and I want to cover that this week for three reasons. One, it was just a good question, and any study of the text is profitable. So right off the top, it's always good to study something. Number two, it involves discussion of a verb form, which will reiterate what we were talking about last week, the five parts of a particular verb. And then the third thing is it's going to give me a chance to sort of give you an example of how I do exegesis. It's not the only way to do exegesis. It's just how I approach the text. Most folks, when they want to understand what the text says, they read it and they go, boy, I don't know what that means. And so they flip down to the bottom of the page in their study Bible and they read whatever the editor of that study Bible wrote. And they go, oh, okay, now I know what that means. That's really not good exegesis. That's just simply reading what the study Bible said. And there's nothing wrong with that, but usually they're limited by space to only it's less word characters than a tweet most of the time because they're filling in the bottom of a column. The second thing people do is they say, oh, well, I'm going to go to a commentary, which is okay. Nothing wrong with commentaries. I've got a bunch of them. But commentaries, again, are the decision of a particular person in their opinion on the text. Commentaries that are very technical can be beneficial. I always tell people, actually, commentaries of people that don't agree with your theological position are hugely beneficial because they will ask questions of the text that you don't, and it'll force you to think through your validation. But the best way to approach the text is what does the text itself say and work through it. By the end of our little 15, 16-week adventure here, you guys, or even right now, you have a handful of tools that are sufficient to do the kind of exegesis we're going to do this evening on this passage in Matthew. So this is the third thing I want to do here then is sort of model what exegesis looks like when I do it. Okay? All right. The passage that we're looking at is Matthew 5, verse 48. Therefore, you shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. That's my loose translation from the Greek. The New King James translation, which happens to be the English translation in this interlinear, is therefore you shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. And the question was last week, well, heck, what does that mean? And for most folks, when you read that verse, it sort of sets up rather a ridiculously high bar. I know myself really well, and while I clean up good to be here in front of all of you, frequently I'm not perfect, as I exhibit on a weekly basis on Thursday nights. And so when I'm told that I have to be perfect as God is perfect, it's like, well, that's just absolutely impossible. And the kind of consolation words that you hear from people is, well, that's the work of the Holy Spirit in your life, this can be a difficult verse. So I want to walk through this because there's some interesting things going on here, and I think that when we get done looking at it, we're going to see that it's a hugely profitable verse, and it's not as discomforting as it seems up front. So the first thing you do when you have something like this is you have to put it in context. What was the author saying here? No single verse or word can be studied outside of its context within the piece that you're reading. In this case, the big section of Matthew that this falls in, and if you look on your notes, I have this, is 4, verse 12 through the end of verse 7, or through the middle of verse 7, or chapter 7, 7:29. So the big piece is 4:12 through 7:29. That's basically the introduction of Jesus as Messiah, the beginning of his public ministry, and the big piece in it is the Sermon on the Mount. And Sermon on the Mount, again, is, I believe, is Jesus as the divinely prophesied Messiah coming to explain the law and the prophets to the people of Israel, from God's point of view. Okay, that's the Sermon on the Mount. There's all kinds of arguments within Christianity, whether it's applicable to us or not. Staunch dispensationalists will say, no, it has no applicability because it's only under the law. We're of the church age. Other folks, Reformed theologians and whatnot, will say, of course it's applicable to us because it's a bunch of commandments within the Bible and we have to pay attention to it. So to me, that's all non-productive discussion because in the text itself, it's Jesus as Messiah teaching Israel this is what the law really means from God's point of view. Our particular little passage here, actually our verse 548 is the end of a passage that starts at verse 17 in chapter 5. And it goes from verse 17 through verse 48 in chapter 5. And it's specifically Jesus, again as Messiah, giving his exposition of the law and comparing it to the false teaching of the religious leaders of the day, of the scribes and the Pharisees. Remember that throughout the Gospels, Jesus is sort of always sparring with the religious leaders of the day, the scribes, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, members of the Sanhedrin. They were the bad guys in the way it's written for us to see. Jesus was saying, look, you guys have it completely wrong. And eventually they reject him as Messiah. I mean, that's why he was put to death. So what we have then is in this particular passage, 517 through 548, is Jesus giving an exposition of the law in comparison to the way that the scribes and Pharisees teach it. And the way that we know that is there's this repeated phrase in there, you have heard it said, right? In every one of these little sections of this whole passage, Jesus starts out by saying, you've heard it said, and then he gives the bad interpretation. Then he says, this is what God means. This is what God meant when he gave us the law. Because remember, Jesus as Messiah is God. So we're getting God correcting the error of man here. Okay, so that's the context. All right, so our verse is in that. This passage is bracketed by 517, the phrase, come to fulfill, not to abolish the law. And then our phrase, 48, is the ending passage, therefore be perfect. So those are the brackets of this section. Okay, I'm not here to get rid of the law, I'm here to fulfill it. And because of that ending phrase, you need to be perfect as your Father is perfect. Okay, so you see how those things work. Okay, now we know the context of this. The next thing we have to do is we have to go through and we have to look at the individual components of this particular verse. I'm going to walk through them sort of in order that they appear in the Greek. You have them in your notes, so you can see it. The first thing that we come into is this word, oun. Now, in your Greek text, if you have it, you'll notice that oun is actually the second word in the sentence. It follows esseste, the verb to be. And that's because a lot of times they put words like un in a post-positive position. It's the second word in. But from the English standpoint, in our word order, it's really the beginning word. It's a grammatical marker that tells us where this verse relates to stuff that came prior to it. Remember, when these texts were written, they were written all in capital letters with no spaces in between the words, right? It's one line after the other. They didn't have all these little editorial headers that we have in our Bibles. They didn't have chapters and verses and everything. So the way that an author had to show people what he was thinking, the argument that was being made, is by adding these grammatical markers into the text. And in this case, un is normally translated therefore. I don't know how English translations sometimes do a little something different. The main English translations, the NIV, the NASB, and the New King James Version and the Old King James Version are the four big Protestant versions. Pardon me. The two Catholic translations are the New American Bible and the New Jerusalem Bible is the current edition. I don't know how those six English translations handle it. Well, New King James does, therefore. But the normal way you translate un out of the Greek into English is therefore. In this case, I think a better translation is to say, in light of then. So in light of all of this stuff that was just came before. Now, The near antecedent of the in light of this is the very section that this is in that starts in, let's see, it's 42. No, I'm sorry, 43. So that the near antecedent of un is it takes you back to 543, this passage on love your neighbor, okay? But in the larger context, it really does take you all the way back to 517, okay? So the direct closest antecedent to it is everything from 543 to 548. The bigger context, everything from 517 to 548. The key issue there is that un tells you that, therefore, what I'm going to say next is based on what I just said. That's what Matthew's saying there. So based on this stuff that we just said, first of all, the love of your neighbor, but in a larger part, the exposition of the law compared to the Pharisees, Jesus' exposition. In light of that, then, and now we have our verse. Okay, you see how that? It's a grammatical marker telling us where to go. Okay, the second thing that we have is this verb here. Esthete. Now, it's a form of the verb to be. The verb to be in Greek is eimi. This particular form, if we parse it out, is a second person plural, future, middle indicative. Okay? So, the five things that we know about a verb that we learned last week. My clever tie-in to last week's class. The first thing a verb has is it has person. This is second person. Second person is you. First person is he, she, is I. Second person is you. Third person is he, she, or it. So this is second person. The number is plural, so it's second person plural. It's you all. Jesus is addressing all the people he's talking to. Okay, you all. So it's second person plural. So there's our person and our number. The next thing that we said a verb has was tense. In this case, it's the future tense. Okay. And we know last week we talked about the future tense as both something in the future, just as in English, but also it has to do with, there are other things we can do with the future tense. I think I talked last week about use of the future, a type of future tense, when we talked about the use of the subjunctive mood with negation. But it's a future tense. That's as we're parsing this out, second person plural, future, okay? That's why when we translate, we use the word will or shall. I'll show you in a minute why shall becomes more important, I think, than the word will. So it says, you shall be perfect. You could say, you will be perfect. So it's future. It's middle voice. Well, that makes sense here because the idea of a person trying to be perfect is sort of almost a completely reflexive idea. I said that last week that the middle voice shows that the subject is doing the action and receiving the results of the action at the same time, or is participating in the results of the action. So if I'm trying to be perfect, I'm both doing the action as well as that perfection is me, right? Because I'm not trying to make you perfect, I'm trying to be perfect, right? So I'm both producing the action as well as participating in the results of the action. Make sense? Okay, that's why it's middle voice. Okay? And the third thing then is that it is, it's in the indicative mood. This is where it gets interesting. The indicative mood, I said last week, and if you see in your notes in the notebook, the indicative mood is, it's the mood of reality or facts. Okay? And it's the normal mood that we use for just saying that things happen. But in this case, there's a really interesting thing. This particular usage of the future indicative here is something that well, there's different names for it. I like to call it the imperatival of future. Okay? The imperative mood, I mentioned last week, is the mood of command. In Greek, when I want to tell you that something happens, I use the indicative mood. When I want to tell you to do something, you do this, I use the imperative. That's the command. In this case, the future indicative is acting as if it was an imperative. It's giving a command. You shall be perfect. So you see, we hear that in English. You hear the command feel to that. It's not saying, and then they were perfect, which would be an indicative idea. It's saying, you shall be perfect. So it's using the future indicative to act like a different mood, to act like the imperative. That's why we have the fancy grammatical title, the imperative in the imperfectible future. You've got to get that "ible" thing on the end of it to make it sound more scholarly. So here we have this future indicative verb now acting like an imperative. It's giving a command. Okay? You shall. Now this is really common when they're translating things from the Old Testament. Okay? And it's really common in Matthew. We see this most of the time in Matthew. Because the stuff in the Old Testament, in Hebrew, when you wrote a command, if you want to literally translate it over to make it sound like that in Greek, you use this future indicative, this imperatival future, and it sounds just like it. The example I gave in the notes, two examples in Matthew, and the one example there in 19 is he's reiterating the Ten Commandments. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not kill. Okay, that you shall not, that command, that's in Greek to make it sound like that Hebrew. You use this future indicative, this imperatival future. It gives it a timeless gravity to the saying, right? It doesn't mean that, you know, when you see in Greek, when we see the reference to the Old Testament, you shall not commit adultery or you shall not kill. It doesn't mean that right now I know you're committing adultery and you're killing each other, and that's going to happen for a while, but at some future point, you're going to... That's not what they're saying. They're saying, here's the rule. Nobody is to kill or commit adultery, or any of the other Ten Commandment issues, right? So that it's not... When it's future, it doesn't mean it's weakened somehow that, well, right now I know you're doing this bad stuff, but in the future you won't. No, it's an all-time command to say, never do this. Does that make sense? It's a way of getting that Hebrew over into the Greek. And we see it in Matthew. And normally it's a reference to the Old Testament, primarily the Pentateuch, the first five books, you know, the law, which is what Jesus is teaching on here. So then we have this grammatical marker that puts it within the context of all the verses. We have the form of the verb to be, estethste, which is telling you that... it's commanding you to be perfect. Okay? Now, the next thing that we find here is this word humes. I said last week that verbs have within them the pronoun or the reference to the subject. In this case, the verb has second person plural, you, right? That's part of the parsing of the verb. I don't need to put a pronoun in the sentence. Okay, because it's already in the verb. It's already part of that verb. Greek does this, English doesn't. Well, why did they throw this pronoun in here, which is you plural? Because it says you plural shall be perfect. You, well, that's redundant. Whenever Greek is redundant, it's trying to tell you something. Okay, the Koine Greek loves to tell you the same thing multiple times to really shake your collar about it. This is important. You listen to me. I'm telling you this two or three times, right? And they're doing that here. They're putting the pronoun you all after the verb that has you all already in it. This is an emphatic use of that pronoun, okay? And what it's saying is it's reiterating it. It's pounding the pulpit about it. A way you could translate into English literally would be, you yourself shall be perfect. Okay, it's not just you all, not just this general body of folks who happen to be, no, you all right here, you yourself shall be perfect. It's emphasizing that. Normally when we have an emphatic use of the pronoun like this, it's setting up a contrast between a couple of subjects. In this case, we see that the contrast in this verse 48 is between us, people, and God, right? The verse says, you shall be perfect just as your Father, right? God the Father in heaven is perfect. So here's the contrast between us and God. You tracking with me on this? The way that I know that's true besides the emphatic use of the pronoun here, that extra humes that doesn't need to be there, but it's there anyway, is there's this little, there's a little pronoun in there, or I'm sorry, a little conjunction in there. Some texts have host, some have hosper. That's a contrast. That's comparing two things, just as. If you open grammars, they love to tell you all the different ways that we compare and contrast things. I mean, there's some have three or four different versions, others have like eight different versions. Okay, but all comparisons really boil down to two things. You're comparing kind, or you're comparing degree. Example, if I say, I am not a woman like my wife, or I am not a woman as my wife, I'll use the same word that's here. I am not a woman as my wife. I'm comparing myself and my wife. I'm not saying that she is somehow a better woman than I am. Oh, I'm a terrible woman. My wife is this great one, right? That's not what I'm comparing, because I'm not a woman, right? I'm a guy. What I'm comparing is a comparison of kind, two different kinds of things. I am not a woman as my wife. She's a different kind of thing than me. I'm a man, and she's a woman. That as is comparing two different kinds. If I were to stand here and tell you, I am not as tall as Shaquille O'Neal, that's a comparison of degree. Both Shaquille O'Neal and I possess the quality of height. He just has a whole lot more of it than I do. Okay? So now I'm comparing a degree of something that I have in common with this other person. You could actually fill in the basketball player of your choice there. Shaquille O'Neal came to mind because I saw him in a TV commercial the other night. So here, I'm not comparing two different things. I'm comparing two things that have the same quality, in this case, height, and I'm comparing the degree of those two things. Does that make sense? This comparison here is a comparison of degree, okay? And we're going to find out what thing we're comparing the degree of, what quality. But there's a comparison here that we find because of this emphatic pronoun, this humes here, is saying you yourself, and we're finding that this is a comparison of degree. Okay, the last word we need to look at thing here is this word perfect. This is where it gets a little tricky. We have in our brains this sort of standard grammar dictionary that we carry around with us. It's just who we are. All people do this, okay? Ours is English. I'm assuming everybody here has English as your birth language. And so we all share this common grammar dictionary in our head. That's why when I say something like, I swam at the beach yesterday, you guys would all recoil in shock that your esteemed Greek teacher could use such terrible English grammar. Because we all know in our little grammar in our brain that that's not how you say swim in the past tense in English, in that context. Okay. The other thing that we have is this sort of dictionary that we all carry, where the words, we all agree on the meaning of words. And that's very helpful because that means we can understand each other when we talk. We understand there's lexical range. Words have a variety of meanings. And we understand that intuitively within the language that's our birth language. If I say run, we all know in our little mental dictionary that primarily means to move very quickly from one place to the next, you know, moving our legs and our feet, right? We run a race. But if I say, oh, I've run out of milk, that means I'm deficient in something, right? It doesn't mean that I'm running. It means that I've run out of milk. If I say I run a business, it means I'm talking about my management ability. If I say my car doesn't run, I'm talking about a mechanical problem. Everybody knows that. You guys, we all share this dictionary, and we immediately go down our list and go, yep, that's definition number 5 for the word run. I get that. If I say a run in pantyhose, okay? That's a material defect. We know that. In our little brain dictionary, we run down, okay, there's run. It means to go fast like in a race, but also, yep, there's that definition there. We don't think about it in real time. I mean, it's just, we understand it, right? And so if I say I was late to church because my wife had a run in her pantyhose, you don't think in your mind, how strange that must be for that woman to try to do a race while putting on her, okay? That, I'm not discussing my wife's lingerie at all at this point, okay? But we know that because we all share this common thing. Okay, where that turns bad for us is when we all have an idea of what a word means and it's in our little mental dictionary, but it may not necessarily be what that word meant in another language or in another culture. Here we have to say, oh, let's take a look at that word. Does it have a meaning I'm not familiar with? For us, perfect means to be without blemish. It's the greatest that you good, better, best, perfect. Okay, it's the ultimate of anything, right? In Greek, the word perfect has a lexical range, kind of like the word run does in English. It can mean something that is perfect, the way that we immediately think of perfect in English, but it can also mean something that's complete. It can mean something that's mature, like an adult versus a child. Okay. In the Gospel of John, the word that we're looking at here for perfect, the verbal form of it is used actually in a it's sort of a technical term for business, first century business, and it means, it doesn't mean perfect or completed, it means paid in full. It's what would be written on a bill if you were buying barley or olive oil or something. So it has a range of meaning here. So now we have to look at it and say, well, what does this mean then? Because in English, we hear you must be perfect like God is perfect, and we think it only means that ultimate, best, no flaw, no blemish, something that we clearly aren't. Well, you guys might be. I'm not. I had a good friend of mine one time. He was giving a sermon at a church I was at, and he was talking about sort of his own imperfections. He's a wonderful guy. And he said, you know, if you folks knew me the way I know me, you wouldn't allow me to preach here. And then he paused for a second. And he said, of course, if I knew all of you like you know all of you, I wouldn't want to preach here. So we all sort of share that introspection that keeps us humble, hopefully. Okay, so this word perfect then, what is it? It's the word atelios, okay? And it means perfect. It means complete. It means mature. It has this range of meaning, okay? So now we have to say, well, how do we know what it means here? Well, one way is that we just go back and we get a good a lexical source that'll take us back. And I did a little work on this week, and this word originally comes from Homer, not the dad of Bart on TV, but the great Greek epic poet. It's a sad thing about our society that if you Google Homer and hit images, like you get 3 pages of Homer Simpson, and then finally you get this little picture of Homer, the great Greek poet, you know. So I think we've shifted somewhat culturally. But this word, and when Homer used the word, it meant unblemished animals that were used for sacrifice. Okay? Kind of gives you an idea. Here's sort of perfect, unblemished animals that we, because we all know when we're sacrificing to our gods, we want to make sure it's the best possible. I have a friend who's Buddhist, and he's at the store finding the most perfect fruit. He'll search through all the apples and all the oranges because he takes them home and puts them on the altar that he has to Buddha, because that's important to him, to have a perfect-looking piece of fruit for his altar. We know Israel had the unblemished animals that were used for sacrifice. So it's a common idea here. Homer was not talking about Jewish sacrifice, by the way. He's talking about pagan sacrifice. So this idea of somehow there's a cleanliness or an unblemished nature to this comes into the word. By the time it gets up to the first century, and I think I gave you the definition there, it comes in the idea of fully developed, but fully developed in a moral sense. That our morals, our conscience, is fully developed. That's what it's doing in this passage. So when it's saying that you're to be perfect as your Father is perfect, it's saying that you need to be morally fully developed and mature. Okay? Now, to make sure that we're getting this right, and it's not just me saying this because I thought it looked good, the thing that you do when you're doing exegesis is you have to validate what you come up with. anybody can pick up the text, get a couple of good Greek grammars, and just make hay with what's there. But you have to validate. How do you prove that that's true? Well, one of the ways that you validate this is, again, back to the context of this. Jesus is in the first century, and he's talking to first century Jewish people. Okay? So there's a cultural identity there that they all share. Right? We, on the other hand, are 21st century Christians. And all of us here in the room are 21st century Southern California Protestant Christians. So we may be very different than, let's say, a Northeastern Irish Catholic. Okay, so we have to understand that we're in our particular set. And this speech that Jesus was giving is set in the first century to first century Jews. So for them, they understand this. Jesus says, I'm going to talk to you about the law and the prophets. They immediately get that. They know the law and the prophets. They've heard it since they were little tiny kids. It's in the temple. It's in the synagogues. They've memorized it. They know the law and the prophets the way we can just run off John 3:16 without even thinking about it, right? So he's talking to them, and he says, you shall be perfect the way your Father in heaven is perfect. They immediately go, oh, that phrase is all over the law and the prophets. For us, it's all over the Old Testament, right? So the way we validate the meaning in the New Testament is we go back and we take a look at the Old Testament. And the way that we do that, in this case, is we're going to look at two places where we have similar phrases in the Old Testament, both within the law, Leviticus and Deuteronomy. Okay? Now, if we go first to Leviticus, the first place we see a similar phrase is Leviticus 9, verse 2. Speak to the whole congregation of the Israelites and tell them, you must be holy because I, the Lord your God, am holy. So there's this idea. We have to be holy as God is holy. Okay? They would have heard that in Jesus' words. And that's what he was referring to. He wasn't making this stuff up brand new. He is telling them the true understanding of the law and prophets. So that's, we find this in Leviticus. We find it again over in Leviticus 20, 26. You must be holy to me, because I, the Lord, am holy, and I have set you apart from the other peoples to be mine. And then immediately after that, we talk about stoning people to death when they have familiar spirits. So we skip that verse, and we just stay on the be holy as I am holy, right? Both of those instances are the exact same kind of phrase. But the Hebrew uses a particular word there for holy. It uses the word kadosh. Okay, that's the Hebrew word that means holy. It, when you drill down into it, it means something that is set apart. Okay, the instruments for worship in the temple were set apart from all other things. Kadosh has this idea of holy, meaning you are set apart, you're separated. And so there we have this word kadosh, and when it's translated over into Greek, into the Septuagint, they translate it not as our word teleios, but they translate it as the word hagios, which we talked about in here a while back. Hagios is the Greek word for holy. It's pretty much a direct translation from kadosh in Hebrew into hagios in Greek. Now let me talk for a minute about the Septuagint, just to make sure everybody's on track here. The Septuagint, which is frequently written in the Roman numeral LXX, when you see that, that's the nomenclature for the Septuagint. I apologize if I'm telling you something you already know, but I'm going to give you a 30-second description of what the Septuagint is. Hundreds of years before Jesus ever walked on the earth, the Jews had been scattered. Okay, they were all over the place. They'd been in exile. Some came back. Some stayed. They were all over the place. And the Hebrew language that they all spoke when they were going into the land, they didn't speak anymore. Okay, most everybody spoke Greek. Alexander the Great, 350 AD, went out, conquered everything. First night of class, I talked about the spread of the Greek language. So the majority of people spoke Greek. They didn't speak Hebrew anymore. Okay, so the Jews had to make a translation of their sacred scriptures out of Hebrew into the common language of the day, which happened to be Greek. And we know that in the providence of God, he has always made sure that his word was translated into the common language of people. Today we have the Bible translated into hundreds of languages, right? So that's what the Jews did. The Septuagint was a translation by the Jews, for the Jews, of the Old Testament, the law, the prophets, and the writings, into Greek from Hebrew, so that everybody could have a copy of it that they could understand. Okay, this LXX is the Roman numeral 70. The reason why, and Septuagint is the word, it's the Latin word 70. The reason why it's called the 70 is the wonderful story about how this translation was done was that 70 rabbis all went into separate little booths at the exact same time with their copy of the Torah, the writings, and the prophets, and they sat down and they translated into Greek, and they all got done at the exact same time, and they all came out, and when they laid out their 70 translations, they all agreed 100% with no mistakes or errors, and that was a sign from God that this was a true translation of His word from Hebrew into Greek. Because of that story of the 70 rabbis, everybody calls it the Septuagint, the Latin word for 70, and because it's easier to write LXX than it is to write the word Septuagint every time, this is when you read a commentary and they're referring to this Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, it's called the Septuagint. That's LXX. Okay, that's just a quick background on this. The key thing to remember, it's a Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament by the Jews, for the Jews, hundreds of years before Jesus was born. Okay? So this is a good thing for us, because now in the New Testament, which is in Greek, if we want to see what these Old Testament words look like in Greek, we go to the Septuagint. And we say, how did they translate? You know, what did the Jews translate that? What did they mean by it? Right? Because now we know, well, I understand the Greek, so now I know what they were thinking when they made their translation. So in this case, those passages in Leviticus where it says, you'd be holy as God is holy, they translated the word kadosh into the Greek word hagias. That doesn't exactly help us for our target passage, right? I mean, it gave us a snappy explanation of what the Septuagint was, but it doesn't help us understand the passage because it's a different word, right? Remember, our word there is teleoi, teleos, right? And the Greek and the Septuagint is hagias. So now we have to look for other passages that, again, have this similar structure, you be holy as God is holy kind of structure. And we find one of those in Deuteronomy. Okay? So you go to Deuteronomy 18. And 18, verse 13. You must be blameless before the Lord your God. Now, that's the NET translation that I use. You may have a different one if you've got NIV or some other translation, okay? But it's the same structure of you have to be, in this case, they translate the word blameless. You have to be perfect as God is. That's what this verse is saying. And if we look at this, there's a different Hebrew word there. It's not kadosh now, it's tamim. That's just the plural form of the Hebrew word tome. Now, when the Septuagint translated tome over into Greek, it used teleois. Okay? So here it uses our word that we have in our passage, in a similar structured passage in the Old Testament. So here in Deuteronomy, we're hearing you have to be perfect, just as God is perfect. And now in our passage, in the New Testament, it says you have to be perfect as God is perfect. Oh, okay, now I'm seeing that this is an idea that Jesus was trying to teach them about the law and the prophets that they would have heard. They would have heard that word, because we assume this was done in Greek, they would have heard that word and said, oh, that he's pointing at that Deuteronomy kind of passage, not those Leviticus passages, because that was kadosh. Also, interestingly enough, if you look at the Leviticus passages, there's another word in there. You must be kadosh, you must be holy, ki means for. You must be holy because I, the Lord, am holy. When it came over into Greek, they used the word hati. Hati in Greek is a conjunction that says the same thing as ki in Hebrew. It says because. Those passages in Leviticus, God was saying, you have to be holy because I, the Lord, am holy. You see, I'm your God, and I'm holy, So you have to be holy too, because you're my people, right? Because I'm holy, you have to be holy. It's a different idea than the Matthew passage we're looking at, right? The Matthew passage is a comparison. The Leviticus passages are, because God is holy, you have to be holy. I mean, that was the whole purpose of the law, right? How Israel could be holy in the face of a holy God, right? That was why you didn't wear two different kinds of fabric, and why you didn't cook a goat in its own mother's milk, and all these other things that you had to do in the law, right? That was how you were holy. Does that make sense? So those Leviticus passages not only have a different word, but they have a different structure. Because God is holy, you have to be holy, because you're God's people. The Deuteronomy passage is like our Matthew passage. You are blameless. You are perfect as God is perfect. It's making that comparison idea that we find in Matthew. So now what does this mean? We've got the context. We understand how Matthew put it. We've looked at each component of this verse, painstakingly so. Right? We've looked at our grammatical marker, telling us where our verse fits. We looked at the verb and said, okay, that means that you shall be. It's giving you a command, okay? You shall be this way. And it's a timeless a command without bound, like you shall not kill, okay? We looked at this extra humes that's in there, this extra pronoun, and said, oh, that's an emphatic use of the pronoun. It's setting up a contrast. What's the comparison? It's between God and man. Okay, so I've got a comparison. What are we comparing? Well, we're comparing this word, teleoi, right? Perfect. And then we look back in the Old Testament, in the law, to see how does that word work in there, and we see a similar structure in Deuteronomy, and it's making the same comparison. So now that we know all of this, we know that perfect doesn't mean without fault or, you know, whatever. We know that perfect means that we're fully mature morally, right? So what does this mean? Now we draw a conclusion after all that work, okay? And I wrote the conclusion out here in the meaning. The law was there to teach us righteousness. It was to teach Israel how to be holy in the face of a holy God, okay? So now what we're called on to do, or first we see the display of this righteousness, Jesus is saying in this passage, is in the relationships we have with each other in the kingdom. You look at this passage, 5:17 through 5:48, and it's all about relational issues. You're not to do adultery. You're to love your neighbor. It's all these, it's not to, you're not angry at your brother. You don't think about killing him. You know, it's all relational issues. I don't mean to get pop psych on this, but it's really clear. This is relationship stuff. It's how one person in the kingdom relates to another person in the kingdom. Okay? So the righteousness that we're called to by the law is displayed in our relationship with each other in the kingdom. Tracking with that so far? Okay. Now, we come up to this idea that then these relationships, okay, we're to imitate the perfection of God. The moral perfection of God, then, the righteousness that we are to show is to imitate this moral perfection of God in our own life. How do we do this? We do this by the proper relationship with each other. We don't hurt each other. We don't emotionally hurt each other. We don't physically hurt each other. We love each other. Not just because we're loved back for what we can get out of it, but truly we love each other to truly love each other, right? So then this moral, this attribute of God, this perfect holiness and love that God has as one of his divine attributes, we are to mirror in our own life holiness and love in our relationships with each other. This is not perfectionism, okay? There is a branch within modern Christianity, well, it's been around for a long time, not just modern, that teaches sinless perfectionism, okay? It teaches that we should and can be sinlessly perfect in our life. Okay, that's just not biblical. I don't mean to bash other groups of Christians. That's not what I do. But this just isn't biblical, okay? We know it's not because the Bible tells us it isn't. Romans 3:23 tells us that we were never perfect to begin with, right? All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, okay? So I'm not perfect. I never was. Bible tells me that really clear. All have fallen short of the glory, and that means all of us, okay? It's not just like a generic, it means every single person has fallen short of the glory of God. We also know that even though I'm a believer, we're all believers and we have eternal life and all this stuff, we're still not perfect right now, and we won't be. 1 John tells us that if we say that we're without sin, what do? We're calling God a liar. Okay? So the New Testament clearly says we never were perfect, and we're never going to be perfect at the end either. I mean, the only time is when we're glorified after our death, right? The work of the Holy Spirit now is to clean us up and make us Christ-like during our life. That's sanctification. But that process will never be over. When you die, it hasn't finished yet. It's not till you're glorified, okay? So this idea that there could ever be sinless perfectionism, no matter how much I try to avoid whatever particular sin du jour I think I have to get rid of, it's just not biblical. So what this is talking about is not sinless perfectionism. It's talking about exhibiting in our own life this mirror of the perfect holiness and love of God in our own mature moral sense that we interact with each other. Does that make sense? So you see this process of when we study a verse. It takes more than 2 minutes, okay? But this is how you do it. You look at the context of the verse. Then you go through and you look at the content. You really pick the verse apart. Look at every single word in there. Some won't matter. Others will be more important, right? Verbs are usually hugely important, okay? And then you go back and you validate it. You say, well, how do I know that the conclusions I reached were true? Well, you look, in our case, we look back where Jesus said he was teaching from. We look back in the law and say, oh, yep, I see what you're teaching. It's right there in the law. Yep, says the same thing we think this says. And then we draw our conclusion from that. So that's kind of how you would do exegesis on a passage. And I know it's easier just to open a commentary and read what somebody else read, but you can't guarantee that the person that wrote that commentary did all of this work, or that they did all this work and then validated it appropriately, okay? Here's a comment about this. I'm doing this in the context of a class that's teaching you about Greek. It's teaching about the original language of the text. Clearly, as we did this, we went into the original Greek text to understand this verse. We don't need to. This verse is completely understandable from the translation, from our English text, okay? We can use the same context clues, with the exception of the discussion of the emphatic humes, the redundant pronoun, and the discussion of the future, the imperatival future. Those are the only two things that are really specific to the Greek, but they're implied in the English anyway. So we could have done all of this solely from our English Bibles. Or if you're a Christian living in France or Germany or whatever, you could do it from your language text, right? We do it here because that's what we do. We're drilling down into this. We're looking at the text. We're trying to learn the text, the Greek text. So that's why we did this. But we could have done this just as easily only from our English Bibles, okay? That's important because what happens is we've created this sort of weird modern-day evangelical Gnosticism within Christianity that drives me nuts. And I honestly used to be this way. Years and years ago, I kind of leaned this way myself, and it was wrong. We give the impression that somehow just Joe Sixpack Christian on a Sunday morning in the pew with their little English Bible just can't understand the true, real deep meaning of the text because they don't read Greek or Hebrew or Aramaic in the case of Daniel. That's not the case. There's nothing in that Greek text that's secret that isn't there in our English text. What the Greek text does is it helps us to validate and understand the depth of what the English text says. But we could do the same thing out of the English text. So what we just did here was in the context of a language class, but it's not like, oh, I can only do Bible study like that. If I just read my text and compare it to other verses, I could never get to the true meaning of the text only in English or German or whatever language you have the Bible in. That's not the case. So it's important that what we did was good. We used the original language and we worked through these exegetical things, but it wasn't necessary. English could do this just the same as the Greek. Okay, it's really important because what you have is you have people going, oh, well, I can't trust my English Bible. Now, granted, if it's the NIV, you probably can't, but I bag on the NIV all the time. It's so funny. I jokingly call it the nearly inspired version and just all kinds of stuff. And it's rude of me, and I'm sure that if the editing committee of the NIV ever had heard of me at all, they would throw a stone at me if I walked by. But we have incredibly good translations, okay? Even our bad translations are good, okay, compared to some folks. I know a lot of folks in Wycliffe and the Seed Company, and they're translating the Bible into languages that have never even been written before. So, you know, God has just, I mean, an abundant blessing on us that we have these great translations. So we should never worry that somehow there's some secret knowledge that a handful of guys that know Greek happen to know that nobody else can get. So what we did tonight could have been done only in the English. Okay. We got started late, so I'm watching the clock. I'm trying to keep us on track for just about an hour or so here. And I don't want to run out of tape in the reel-to-reel machine either. So I do want to look at participles, just an introduction to participles. I'll cover them more clearly next week. Participles are verbal adjectives, okay? Boy, our little brains are just packed full of stuff tonight. You're just going to have to go home and just like, I don't know, turn on like a kid's channel to just let your brain kind of go, right? Participles are verbal adjectives, and in other words, they do two things. They have a verbal side and they have an adjective side, okay? I had this Greek teacher who was an amazing man. He still is. I mean, he's alive. He's not passed away. It was an amazing guy, and he used to always do this great thing. When you talk about participles, he'd say, now they're, and I am not doing a good impersonation of them either. He'd say, now participles are verbal adjectives. Sometimes they're verbal adjectives. And other times, they're verbal adjectives. Okay, he did this great sort of thing. And that works now that this is on YouTube, because now people can see that. You see, it used to be they'd just hear it online on an audio, and they wouldn't see the marvelous choreography. But they are. They're verbal adjectives. Sometimes the verbal part's more prominent. Sometimes the adjective part is more prominent. But they're verbal adjectives. In order to understand Greek participles, which are really kind of complex at times, it's easiest if we first understand what the participle is in English, right? So that we can then have something to compare to. In English, a participle is the ing word, right? We throw ing on the end of the word. That's the form that we have for participles in English. And when they're verbal, English participles show process. I know if you read English grammars, they'll tell you they tell you continuous action. I pontificated on that last week, saying how I didn't like the idea of continuous. I prefer the word process, because continuous, again, in our little dictionaries in our heads, sometimes we get that word wrong. So they show process. In other words, if I say I am teaching, teaching's my participle. And that's what I'm teaching. I've been teaching for 45 minutes now. Okay, so it's showing a process. It's a verbal idea. They can also be used as an adjective in English, right? You are charming students. There's our participle there, charming. It's got our little ing on the end of it, and it's an adjective, okay? It's describing the students are red, white, and blue, or they're all curly-haired or something, right? It's saying how they are here, right? You are charming. It's an adjective. It's a verbal adjective, okay? So those are the two main ways that we use participles in English. I am teaching as a verb, showing process, or as an adjective to describe the verbal idea. You are charming students. And that's so applicable to this class. You guys are so much better than the class I taught last week. Okay, the other thing that we have in English that looks like a participle is a gerund. Okay? Gerunds look like participles in English, but they're really nouns. They function as nouns. Whereas participles in English function as verbal adjectives, gerunds really, they look like participles, but they function as nouns. So if I were to say, teaching Greek is fun, okay, my subject in that sentence is teaching. It looks just like this participle over here, but it's really functioning as a subject. So technically, in English, it's not a participle, it's a gerund. Okay? If I say, they love my teaching. Notice how this is so self-centered for me? This is just like a big ego thing, right? It's all about me tonight, everybody. They love my teaching. Teaching looks the same, but here, it's the object, right? It's the object of love. What do they love? They love my teaching. So there, it's a part. It looks like a participle. It's that ing word, but it's functioning like a noun. Here in this case, it's the direct object. So in English, that's a gerund. Greek sort of rolls all these ideas together. Okay. In Greek, a participle is a verbal adjective, just like it is in English. In Greek, we build participles off of verbs. So any verb in Greek, we can make a participle out of it. Okay? But remember how I said in Greek there are five parts to any verb, right? There's person, number, tense, voice, and mood. For a participle, because it's built on a verb and it's a verbal adjective, it'll have, part of it will look like a verb, part of it will look like an adjective. So it'll have combinations of things that we've talked about that are verbal and things that are noun-like, adjective-like. So a participle on its verbal side, it will have tense and voice. Right? Remember from our five things in our verb, two of those come over into the participles, tense and voice. Because it also is an adjective, it'll have things that adjectives have. Okay? It'll have case, number, and gender. So a participle has two verb things and three adjective things. Okay? So as you're working through the participle, you've got to recognize these different things. You've got to recognize its tense and its voice. You also have to recognize, most often, its case. That's hugely important. Number and gender is also important for agreement. So when we're analyzing a participle, we have to look at those five things. Just like when we analyzed a verb, we had to look at the five things for the verb. Okay? Those five things pretty much give us most of the stuff that we talk about with the English participle, just in a slightly different form in Greek. But the function is very similar. Okay, participles, unlike verbs, we talked about all the different tenses of verbs. You have those in your notes. Participles only show up in three tenses. Okay, they show up in the present, the aorist, and the perfect. The present tense participle will always be this process action. Okay, aorist participle will always be event action. The other way is to say undefined action. And the perfect participle will always be completed action. So you've got three types of action when it comes to participles. Ongoing, process action, completed action, or undefined. We don't know whether it's process or event. It's just undefined. Those are the key things in participles. Whereas verbs have, you know, all these other tenses, right? Participles just have three. Perfect, aorist, and present. Okay, I think that's where I'll stop tonight, just because my brain will probably explode, and I don't know about yours, but we've just packed it with stuff tonight. So, an interesting thing this week would be to Google, or Bing, or Yahoo, or whatever search engine you choose. Google has kind of replaced like Coke and Kleenex. It's just like a standard word for something we do. It's actually a verb now, you know? So go home and search engine. I get no advertising revenue from saying Google, so I mean, it's not even like I'm getting 2 cents every time you click on me when I say it. But go home and search English grammar and look up participles. And just see what it says. Get a feel for that, because if you get a feel for what participles do in English, when we start talking about what they're doing in Greek, I think it'll help you a lot. This is a case where knowing what participles do in English, I think, lays a great foundation for what they do in Greek. Other things we can say, Greek and English are similar, they're dissimilar. Participles, it seems to really help. So look at that this week. And I think that's it. Any questions? Please, can I go home now, please? Okay. That's it.
Hey, I do have a question now that you can go off.
Wait a minute.